everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Sport Kite Podcast. I am your host, Nick O'Neill, and I wanted to thank you for tuning in and listening. As always, if you like what you hear here on the podcast, consider going to buymeacoffee.com/sportkite and chipping in a few bucks. Every little bit really does help keep the podcast hosted going forward and doing all that great stuff. So a big thank you to all of you that have supported us over these four seasons. We really, really do appreciate it. With that, I'm going to make this a very short introduction because I want to get into the second half of the conversation that I had with John Baresi. We're going to hop back in kind of right mid-conversation where we were talking about your approach as your I guess, philosophy and ethics and how you approach the kite field as a competitor and how that translates into being just a performer or just going out and flying with your friends. There's a lot that can be kind of cross-pollinated across all of that, the skills that we should use no matter what kind of flying we're doing. After that, we follow into a little bit more information for someone who is just kind of starting their journey on being an enthusiastic flyer, really diving deep into this hobby. What are some things that you can learn, how you can refine those skills, and things that will really, really benefit you the more that you spend time on them early on. All right, so let's go ahead and kick off the remainder of this interview. And yeah, I hope you like it.
Right? Yeah. And then personally, for something that I teach the athletes I work with, and granted, we play a team sport, so it's a little bit different, but I think there's still a lot of good takeaway is we harp hard on good sportsmanship. So Understandably, you're doing something and something goes wrong and you just get in, you get in your feefies, you're getting in your feelings, right? And either you beat yourself up or you just feel real crappy and you're like, man, I'm just so angry. It's like, okay, you've got 1 minute to feel that. And then what you're going to do is you're going to turn around and you're going to turn to a teammate and you're going to say something positive to them, or you're going to positively support the other team, or you're going to do something else that pulls you out of that space. And you are not allowed to sit in that space and be negative to everybody just because you had a bad moment.
That's exactly what I try to employ at home. When I feel myself losing my shit just on something that I know I shouldn't be, go do something good. Go do something constructive.
Yeah. Honor the fact that you have that feeling. Let yourself have that feeling for a minute and then be like, okay, I'm going to go focus on this thing right now. Mm-hmm. And on our bench, we teach that you have to like be supportive of the other team. It doesn't matter if they're being shitty to you, be supportive of the other team, be supportive of the refs, be supportive of this, right? And a lot of the feedback that I've gotten from the athletes, they're like, it has completely changed how I look at the sport, right? Because now I'm not looking at enemies. I'm looking at, wow, that person beat me. How did they beat me? I want to understand why I got in this position. And so they're now, they've moved into that growth mindset and everything's just better.
Well, it greases the wheels, right? Every single person in whatever position they are, or however they take that tact in their own way, it's creating a culture, right? It creates a culture. And so even the team that you go help, they're like, one of my favorites is, you know, it just as an organism on a competition field, if you have, you know, every once in a while, at least in my history and all of the competitors I've seen in my life, there's going to be some team that, God bless them, but they're a shit show. Yeah. I mean, you know, just like, and I, what I mean by that is like, you know, they just, whatever it is with their doctrine in how they're setting up kites will launch accidentally, or they might have the wrong handle. So you kind of get a read on, you know, this, whatever it is, the skill level or the attention level or whatever it is, they are who they are. It's not like they're not trying, but when you pick those, you catch those points and you find the patterns and you go back those problems up. So you stand close enough to that kite that, you know, by now it's probably going to launch accidentally or, you know, maybe reach out and hold that right line and jiggle it, make sure their right hand moves, you know, that sort of thing. But not only the profitability of converting whatever negative energy you might be feeling, but how that rolls down through the whole culture of the event and keeps it moving. And frankly, you never do it for that reason, but that's what the other competitors think of you. Hey, that guy was there, that lady was there, back me up. That's the judges peripherally will pick up on that. And that's not going to win you any trophies, but it all greases the wheel. You're part of the solution, not just throwing wrenches,
Yeah. Yeah. And especially for a sport like ours, where, there's not that many competitors out there that are active right now. We don't have big ticket sponsors at the door that we're all fighting for, the $1 million signing deals and stuff like that. We are still all small scale supporting each other. Mm-hmm. Your reputation goes a long way. And your reputation as a competitor, your reputation as a performer. I feel, and I've seen this over the last decade, I feel that the attitude side of your reputation that you bring to the field, that has become a lot more important than necessarily your skill level, if that makes sense.
To a degree,
mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. I've seen people who just are not that great of flyers, and they are consistently invited everywhere because they represent well. They are positive. They are out there. They are helping the community. They're helping other flyers, right? Does it translate to a competition? Not necessarily.
But it does make you a little bit more. Energy is energy, right? So if you're standing out there doing, how many times have we seen some demo performer that, as you described, they're not necessarily at a high technical level. They're not hitting the buckets. They don't have a program. They're not chaptering their performance.
But no.
By God, if there isn't something about watching them that just, I just can't look away. Like, what? This is kind of fun. Like,
you know what?
It kind of makes me want to go fly my kite right now.
Yeah. The other thing that I kind of wanted to touch base on, because you've used the word vocabulary a lot to talk about the different flying and stuff like that. And it reminded me that I'm going to mess up this analogy, but it reminded me of someone had told me once that if you look at, sport kite ballet as you are speaking a foreign language to someone else, and you both think that you maybe know the language, you recognize some of it, right? Mm-hmm. So hopefully the person watching it is understanding what you're saying, but you both don't necessarily, you're not speaking words that both of you necessarily understand. Right? So it's kind of like, I'm just hoping you kind of get the flavor of what I'm trying to tell you without actually knowing the language that I'm using.
That analogy would have never popped into my head, but I like it very much. It works. It totally works. Right down to accent. Mm-hmm. You're doing the same thing, but it's got a little something on it. I kind of smell it,
Yeah. Like, okay. I get that you're giving me this feeling, and I'm getting the feeling from what you're doing. And that directly translates to whether or not someone understood your performance.
So competition really, I think, is just could you articulate or work that tempo a little bit more so I could follow what you're doing?
Yeah. Anyways, all right. Well, we've talked a lot about beginner competition, or competition in general. And I know I've had a lot of listeners write in and talk about just beginner tips. So maybe not competition. And I know you already mentioned something that I'm gonna super highlight, because I think everybody needs to hear this 10,000 times, is the talk about field etiquette, how you were talking about coming to like a competition field, and there's an infield, and you wait before you go out there. You don't just lay your stuff out everywhere. You wait mm-hmm. before you go out there. You set up your stuff, you do your thing, and then you get out of the way, right? So mm-hmm. other people can enjoy that. And I think that absolutely translates to just even a general kite flying field, right?
I think it translates in two ways. One, I think you've got a segue for it, but the first one that I want to point out, because living in Long Beach, it's a drive-on beach, Long Beach, mm-hmm. Washington, and there's a certain area that in theory is a no-drive zone, but let's say I've got 120 feet of string strung out, right? And there's nobody around. So in this particular instance, I'm not consuming anybody else's kite space, but I've got this line set out there. And to me, it's a very obvious thing, right? But at the end of the day, it's important to remember that, you know, as a beginner, especially, that most people honestly would never expect a trip line to be strung out in the middle of a 26-mile beach. Especially if you're in a place where people are sort of eyes open, chin up, in a state of wonder, looking around, they just don't even understand the number of times that I've seen somebody walking like right by a kite, and they think the kite is like, I'm sure somewhere in their mind they think it's just a detached statue there that's standing up by itself, you know, yeah, while it's on the ground.
We're like, how did you not see it? And it's like, well, yeah, if you're not, you know.
So the moral there for me is take responsibility for mm-hmm. your own safety. And it's really, I think, any kite flyer's responsibility to be aware of other people and not, I mean, you hope that they're aware. You hope that they understand and they avoid things. But I've come to a state of mind where I simply assume the likelihood that they might not. And that comes yes. down to vehicles driving, kids running, dogs, everything. I take firsthand responsibility. Obviously, there's a certain point that you're going to run into on occasion where you just have belligerent or obstinate people. But as a whole, in living where I live and having as many kites as I usually have set up on the beach at one time, I run into exquisitely few problems because I'm usually proactive and I head it yeah. off. And I've practiced how to try to trigger awareness without necessarily aggravating. One of my pet peeves is yelling at other people. Like, don't yell at them. Get their awareness, and you know. But yeah. My favorite thing is allowing someone else to self-discover. So if you somehow build some sort of a response pattern that allows them to suddenly realize that there are strings on the ground, then they're like, "Oh, look what I saw! I'll just avoid that. I'm so smart."
Yeah, I'll just walk over here. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then of course there's sharing the field with other flyers.
Yeah, yeah, I'm very adamant about if you're, you know, we'll use the Long Beach example, right? You guys have miles and miles of beach you could stretch out on, right? But even if there, say, 10 of us all show up and we're hanging out together, and maybe I'm flying this kite and then I want to go switch to another one and then I want to switch to another one, I'm not going to leave them all laying out lines out, right? Even if we're all friends and we're good friends, right? And we know each other, we know where lines are, we know to look for that shit. It's creating obstacles on the field. It's potentially putting my kite at risk. It's mm-hmm. it's just a pain in the ass. Just wrap it up, right? Or stack the kites in a certain spot, or just kind of all collectively agree, like, yeah, we're going to police our stuff. We're going to clean stuff up. It's just, to me, it makes the process of flying safer, funner, and better.
I sometimes think of the idea of those who engineer a supermarket. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at a supermarket from the top down, right? So you're looking at the flow of the aisles, and you're looking at can the cashier see all of the spots where the shoplifters might be, and are they going to get the cold stuff? As you look at a field, you start to think about the flow patterns. So, you know, based on which way is the wind going, are there areas where vehicles need to pass through, all that stuff. It just basically comes down to full field awareness as well. and not just, oh, here's a hole, and then just pouring stuff out into it. But you want to look at yourself top down inside the kite festival and see how you sit in it. That's an important factor, you know, especially when space gets, less and less wide open. Especially running big teams, quite often I'm sometimes guilty of not getting everything put away for a period of time. Because sometimes we're also very opportunistic, so I don't excuse that completely. But in any case, when we do ground our stuff, we do try to condense it, keep it down to a real small package, have people that are aware of the lines or position ourselves based on flow, or having one or two of us that have got eyes on stuff, and we try not to leave anything out for too long. But I think especially in a festival environment, when you have closed fields, so like if you have a large demo field, I don't care how big it is, you don't necessarily, you know, that's a demo field. It's not open beach where you drop your cooler for the day and okay, that's your spot, however you want to argue that, right? But that's a demo field. So if you're not using the demo field, either crunch that stuff way off deep into the corner where it is clearly not compromising any of the flying area, or pack it up, roll it up, even better. And for me, honestly, a lot of that comes down to being really self-honest about what your level of awareness is and how you manage your gear. So like, and again, it, only in particular situations, but like my team, even when we land our kites, we don't just land them wide open. We talk about a full wingtip overlap. So we're actually taking the kites and overlapping every single kite by 1/3 and getting them closer together. We're staking off all of our handles like really, really close together. So the other thing that we talk about is safety in numbers. So if you're working with a team, the more handles and the more lines and the more kites you have in a single tiny channel, the more visible you are. So yes. Not only do you take up less room, but it's really, really hard to miss that big pile. Whereas if you have one kite and then you go 20 feet and then there's another kite and then 20, it's a lot harder for, again, just general human psychology. They don't necessarily pick up on that. So there's something to be said for safety numbers and you take up less room.
Yeah, in a way it's kind of counterintuitive, right? The more, but you want a tighter space.
Yeah.
I kind of like you referenced, when you go to the beach and you plant your cooler, right? if everybody were to think that their kite is exactly like all the stuff that they're bringing out for a picnic, right? You don't take your stuff from a picnic and just like throw it everywhere. You tend to keep it all close to you, right? You don't want people walking off with it. You don't want people walking through your picnic, right? So you're going to keep everything kind of close to you. And yeah, you may do something and kind of walk away a little bit, but you come back and you bring everything back to your little picnic area where your cooler is, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, we get kind of in a different mindset when we have these things on 120-foot lines because we're like, oh, yeah, it's an extension of me. Well, if it's actively not an extension of you, you're not actively flying. Now it's just an object that's 120 feet away that has a trip hazard. All right. Well, okay. So loaded question. Any other things for new folks that maybe they should keep in mind when they're getting started?
Gosh. I mean, that's a broad question. You know, we talk about new people walking into a kite festival or somebody just flying a kite for the first time, because that's a whole nother conversation.
I guess let's go a little bit with flying a kite for the first time, or actually not flying a kite for a first time, but flying a kite with the intention to actually get better and to get serious about it, right? So this is not someone grabbed a $5 kite and went running down the beach. This is someone that's like, okay, I want to do this. I'm interested in doing this.
All right. There's a few things because my team, a lot of the members in my team I've caught them pretty early in their kite experience. And a lot of them, I've been a part of their introduction to a new format. So whether they're trying dog stake, they've never done dog stake before, or flying a two-line indoor kite, or so maybe they've been flying kites for a long time, but they've been trying a new discipline, and I've been able to be alongside that. And I mean, first of all, there's a few things. One is learn as much as you can about the quality of your launch, and learn as many different ways to land, because that's the start and that's the stop. Right. So you go up and you're flying and you're having fun. But I think landings are one of the first things that any flyer should be learning: your spin landing, your basic 1-2 push stall landing, your snap landing, flying out to the edge and nose up and sit it down. There's like 5 or 6 different primary ways to do that. Recoveries, ground recoveries. So you're learning how to do a basic ground flip or flip over from the nose so the kite's upright. Mm-hmm. If the shape of the kite is right and the engine is right, a leading edge launch where you're pulling one wing forward and then you're flying the kite away from the ground.
That's more dual line than necessarily quad line. Just for any newbie listening.
Sure. Well, I'm gonna go one further and say that I think that our library of information in that community is a little bit more ubiquitous. For whatever reason, we've been able to distribute, and the greater we, sort of an operating standard, and people who get involved in quad line, they come in contact with that pretty quickly.
Yes.
You have the ability of a kite that has brakes
and you can,
right. It's a much more incremental journey. And it's not so much reflex based. Mm-hmm. So I was just having this conversation with a flyer the other day, and that, you know, you could teach a 90-year-old man in a wheelchair how to fly a quad line in a team, right? In theory, because you can win quad with your brain. With a dual line, it is a much more volatile animal ultimately, because it can mistake and lay launch once you have too much tension and so forth. So. Learn as much as you can about setting up the kite securely. You know, there's the old thing of having the kite's dual line, having it sitting up, lean back, and then staked so that it's sort of sitting back like a rocket ready to go. You know, there's a time and place for that, but there's what I've come to term as the trick launch, where you basically, and you can do a little research on this using some of the keywords I'm going to throw, is you basically roll the kite up onto the ground. So if you look up the trick, yo-yo or roll up, you watch it go halfway through that till it's belly down, and then put it on the ground, and then there's a way to actually roll the kite over. So I tend to set up all my dual line kites that way, because if somebody walks through my lines, it's not going to launch. All they're going to do is drag my lines and maybe reposition my kite a bit, which is not always ideal, but it's safe, it's not volatile. So learning, and here's the big takeaway for me too, is that if you know how to land and you know how to relaunch and you know how to recover the kite properly in a variety of ways, you are now self-sufficient. So in essence, no matter what happens, you have control of the kite. And so the amount of weight and stress that that takes off your shoulders is tremendous. And learn, you know, some of the basic premise. By God, learn about the wind window for sure. There's no shortage of good information out there about that. The wind window is really important because it gives you a good sense of where you can dock the kite temporarily. It gives you a sense of where it's easier to land versus where it's harder. Let's see here. What else? Kind of drawn a blank for the moment, but I mean,
yeah, well, I know, yeah, one of the questions I get, and I get this across all sports, is like instantly when people are brand new, they already want to ask questions about how they can tweak or tune their gear. And my response is you need to learn a wind window before you start playing with the nose. Yeah, if you were to have a professional, someone who really understands it, comes in and tweaks it, they may be able to make it better for you. But that is an extra variable you don't necessarily need to deal with if you can't even like go edge to edge, right?
Well, and brand tuning first is such a quirky thing too.
Yeah.
It took me probably a year and a half after I started flying. And granted, I started in the heyday of kiting. I was surrounded. I was already competing. But mm-hmm. I still didn't really understand bridle, like what it meant. Pulling the nose in or laying the nose back is, those are the most common things. Nowadays we're pretty blessed in that, you know, when I started flying the bridles, you actually had to loosen a knot at the connection point and slide it up. And nowadays, almost every manufactured sport kite has a series of knots at the top. So yes. I think for today,
you can adjust. Yeah,
you can adjust. And I have to come back against your first sentiment a little bit in that there are times. The straightforward thing is that, you know, if the kite that you have is just jerking the snot out of you, if when you make a turn, it's like all of a sudden spinning around on a dime or starting to stall or oversteer, that nose is leaned too far back. It is. So there are the little knots at the top spreader. If you just shorten those knots one at a time so that the nose is slowly leaning towards the pilot, the kite slowly becomes a little bit less sensitive. It's spilling more air out the bottom, that sort of thing. And especially as the wind comes higher up, it just makes the kite a little bit more docile and not such a raging monster. But as you're learning to land, as you're learning to stall, some of those nose forward situations, and particularly because a lot of kites are produced very nose heavy, nose forward heavy, as you lean that nose back incrementally, you'll find that the kite will snap stall better or come out of a spin for a landing better. So yeah, you don't want to go crazy on it, but I think that finding out how the bridle adjustment works functionally, how do I move these knots, and then finding a one forward, one back sort of sensitivity, within a provided range is a
exactly
good idea.
moving the bridle a knot is different than I want to rebuild the bridle, and it's like it's just stop. Like, well, just
and I agree with you fundamentally, but it is a challenge because you know, we go back to quad, just touch mm-hmm. on that, is that they all operate the same.
Yeah,
an experienced quad flyer can tell you, they can speak to and detail performance differences of pretty significant measure between the different kites. But at the end of the day, I can pick up any of them and do basically the same thing. With dual lines, there are calicos and there are Maine Coons and there are lions.
Yeah,
they're all basically the same shape, but dual line kites vary so madly in their character, their performance, what they give back to you. And even I've flown like two of the same kite, mm-hmm. but because they've been in different hands and have a slightly different tuning, one I absolutely cannot stand and the other one I could fly for like a week solid.
Yeah,
you definitely want to be careful how much you play with it, but understanding a bit about the bridle and knowing that there are kites that will give you certain things much more readily, mm-hmm. and that some kites frankly are just cursed. They are.
Yes.
and it might be personality dependent. Because there's some flyers that just love kites that I don't like and vice versa. But the personality range on kites is pretty huge. So it's pretty important, I think, to understand that. And the beginner range to me, I think, and we say beginner range, let's say your $55 to $60 starting kite, which is about where any basic dual line performance.
And we'll be clear here. We're talking established brands, not some of the knockoffs you can buy on Amazon. That, like, these are actual designs designed by a kite person.
That's it. Exactly. Yeah. That's the key is, and I think anything that you do, whatever it is, you'd ultimately like to have something that was designed and hopefully manufactured mm-hmm. by someone who has some vested interest in it. When they put it in the box, they went, this will work. As opposed to, we need to make a kite to fill our product line. and boom, there it is. But they don't really know if it's going to fly, nor do they have to deal with the aftermath of whatever that person's experience is. I mean, one of my, as long as I've been in kiting, they see me do something on a kite and they go, oh, that's pretty amazing. I can't even keep a kite in the air. And you know they're talking about single lines. And if a single line is built with any basic sensibility, they literally let the string out and it flies.
Yeah.
It's not something they did. 99% of the people who say that had a crappy kite experience thanks to either
poor design.
Yeah. Poor design, or because the wherever they bought it, there just wasn't the two inklings of information. Well, try launching it with 10 feet of line out, or don't stand behind the building when you take off, you know? So that's another one worthy. So, you know, I talk about some of the things I thought were important to learn first. Being aware of your wind pattern. So any objects behind you, sometimes it's unavoidable when you're an inland flyer. I know, because I've spent years as well flying inland. In whatever your space is, you want to try to position yourself, as long as it's safe and the space is there, as far downwind from the objects. You want to put as much flat land behind you as possible. If there are taller trees on the right and taller trees on the left, but there's a gap through the middle, well, there might be a little bit better wind flowing through that gap. So if you can position that upwind from you, those sorts of things. So becoming aware of that wind flow, remembering that the wind window has texture too, particularly if you're an inland flyer. So what may be light, bumpy, or inconsistent down low might be much stronger and maybe even cleaner up high. So just learning about that texture and how it fits into the shape of that wind window. That's a big takeaway, I think.
I kind of back on the gear issue of, you know, don't tweak your gear just yet. Right. When I'm teaching skating and we've got new skaters coming in, you know, a lot of people are very, very quick to, okay, they put the wheelies on the feetsies and guess what? They're moving awkward and they can't move. And they're like, oh, it's my skates. I'm like, nope. Try this for a month. And if you still have the same exact problem in a month, then we'll look at changing your gear. Because right now you don't have the personal muscle memory, the body mechanics, any of that to fully understand that, yeah, actually your gear is shit, but like you can't even, you're not even at the walking stage and you're talking about buying running shoes, right?
Well,
so like,
yeah, but as an instructor, I talk about it's the law of iteration, right? The law of iteration. So the first time you try, as if you're a dual line flyer, the first time you go in and try a spin landing, you're probably going to miss.
Yeah.
And then if you try it 10 more times without over analyzing it too much, your 10th try is probably going to be better. And then your 30th try, then your 50th try, then your 100th try. It's absolutely a rule of iterations. And even on my own team, we use the same thing. So having been on other teams before, we picked apart a detail. We try it once and we pick at that detail. On my team these days, generally our motto, we just run it 10 more times. And then we come back and talk about the averages, because that's the other thing too, is that there's, as a kite flyer, there's always a little bit of variable in every attempt that you make, the wind or the position or the, however you interface with the kite at that moment. But if you do something 10 times, then you have an opportunity to kind of get a longer average of what the variables are. And then you come back and try that again and again and again. But yeah, repetition is the key. I think a great example is if you just look at how children learn.
Yeah.
I mean, we have the advantage of being older. Sometimes it's advantage, but in theory, we have the ability to intellectualize and digest the details perhaps a little bit better, which does provide an asset. But what makes a child learn so well, and especially with something like kites, is that they just try and try, because they're having fun and they are just immersed in the experience, and they are gaining data at a much higher rate than somebody who's spending so much time thinking about something that they don't even know anything about yet.
Yeah, they.
Why you don't know anything? What do you have to think about?
Children tend to forget about the negative side of failure, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. They're just like, oh, that didn't work. Okay, I'm gonna, you know. So they only remember the positive side of failure, which is this way of doing it didn't work, not I failed.
Yeah.
And holding on to that and moving forward.
And guess what? Kites break.
Yes.
Kites break. They still break. 35 freaking years and my kites still break.
You're still snapping rods. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of, and something I do for all of my athletes here is I actually create a training journal. And I have a handful of prompts in there. And it's just a way to kind of help these adults, you know, remember, like, okay, yeah, just take 5 minutes after you've gone out and done, you know, your flying or done your skating or done your whatever, and just write down a highlight from today or something that you were working on or something didn't work. I was like, because what's going to happen is down the line when you are grinding away at something and you're like, I'm making no progress. I'm doing nothing. Nothing is getting anywhere. You go back and you flip through those pages and you're like, man, a month ago, I couldn't even do X, Y, Z. And now I'm saying like, I'm just not nailing it perfect on the right-hand side of the window. I couldn't even do it a month ago. And now I'm bitching because I can't do it on the right side of the window. Okay. So I've actually made some progress, right? It helps us kind of recalibrate and start forgetting the negative side of failure and start looking at the positive side of failure and go, oh, okay. I'm growing with this. I'm not actually regressing.
Yes. Well, but I think one of the other tools that I've really enjoyed and seen success for a lot of people with is taking video of their body while they're flying from a basically like slightly from the front, but from a like a from a front shoulder angle so that you can see your hands. And what I'm talking about here is not specifically breaking down technique, although that's part of it. Mostly what you're looking for is do you look comfortable?
Yes.
Do you look right. So what you'll see is this high tension. This you'll see the shoulders creep up. So the biggest ones, and these are points of weakness. And I say that with love, right? I work to beat these out of my team members is one, do not lean forward. You know, so like you're coming into land, leaning forward usually doesn't help and it takes you really off balance. Particularly while you're flying, because your weight is not your body is not counterweighted against the kite. So it leaves you forward heavy, again, high tension. If you're holding your hands in too close to your body, that puts the line's point of tension at your hands. So your hands tend to bounce and it makes the kite a little bit more wiggly and harder to control, definitely less precise. So I always think of relaxing and letting the kite have my arms, and what it feels like then is that the tension of the lines travel through my hands and basically like end at the weight of my elbow. So it's like my elbows are almost resting on the lines and my hands just float in the middle. They're just there to change the depth of the handles relative to the kite, but other than that everything's connected to my elbows, which is really more part of my body. A little bit of front facing video. I'm just looking for comfort. Like, do I look cool? Do I look comfortable?
Do I look like I'm pooping or do I look like I'm like relaxed? Right.
Oh no.
Is this painful poop or is this nice and relaxed? That's what I use is with my athletes. I'm like, you pooping? And they're like, oh, and you just see they all of a sudden, oh, okay. Like, yeah, I'm looking a little tense.
Well, I think you could take that analogy to holding a golf club, to firing a rifle. You know, are you choking it or are you settled into it?
Exactly. Like, do you feel comfortable? Because you look like you're constipated. Something I do want to point out, and again, this may be rather redundant for quite a few of the listeners. A lot of what you just, what you described goes for both dual line and quad line. But you did mention not going chest forward. You would do that sometimes with dual line because you need those, you know, like Paul has done that with these huge lunging motions, but there's a caveat there, right? It's not unbalanced chest forward. His hands come behind him. His hands go in front. You don't see
and the legs are tripoded out to support.
Right.
That body
the movement. Legs are massively moving. They're tripoded out. So that's a lot more dynamic flying that you're not going to see in quads. You don't necessarily want to see your quad flyers yanking their hands behind them. You want to see it in front of them most of the time, right?
Yeah.
There's not a huge advantage for them flying back here and then
pretty rare. Yes.
Yeah. And same with their body mechanics. Just like you were describing, you want your body kind of nice and in line and somewhat leaned out against the kite. You don't want to be tipped over forward for most of it.
Well, a frame of reference that I always heard, it's easy to remember, is when I did a little bit of stage performance with kites, someone once said, give your heart to the audience. And so I always think of the third row.
Yep.
And wherever I'm standing, I just pretend that there's an audience in front of me. And I just make sure that my heart is pointing to the third row, not the eighth row, not the 10th row, but it's not pointing to the horizon, the down, the slightly lower than my head. It should be pointing basically at the same altitude that my head is.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also, that just naturally brings your shoulders back and that will naturally bring your center of gravity slightly back because you're going to tuck your core, all that other good stuff.
And point of pride.
Yes. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of using video as a frame of reference. And I know I've talked about this in previous podcasts with some of the other, like the dual line heavy flyers like Paul, you know, because we've talked about, if you're going to do this trick, you need to flick your wrist, right? And it's like, that is such an incredibly vague reference, right? If you know, you know. But if you don't know, and someone says, flick your wrist, you're like, okay, what, you know, like, what does a flick mean? And you could, you know, me as an uneducated flyer, I could be like, I'm doing it. And, you know, Paul's pointing out to me like, no, you're not. And I'm like, yeah, I am.
In quad line for us, that would be line tension.
Okay.
So if you say to somebody line tension, they just keep pulling on the string because I have to keep tension in it. And it's more like a state of suspension where you're just keeping a connection. But the same thing, if somebody doesn't know, you could describe it to them, but until they feel it, and time after time, and once they feel it, it's almost like a drug. They're like, oh my God, it feels so good.
Right. And you know, using that video though as direct comparison, right? Because if I watch Paul, you know, he flicks his wrist to do this thing and I'm like, okay, I'm doing that. And I do it. And he's like, no, you're not. And takes a video and shows it right to me. Then it's like, oh, I'm not. I feel I am, but I'm not. Okay, so how can I get more of a, I need to get more of a snap. I'm not getting enough of a snap. I need to do more of a snap. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of video and self-assessment through video and self-reflection and all that. And, you know, we've talked about trying to have it in the sport kite world. And I think you've done a little bit of it through your business is video coaching. But I definitely think there needs to be more of it, you know, where someone could send in like a video and be like, hey, here's me trying to do a half axle from five different angles. Why am I not landing it? Or why am I not getting it? And you could be like, well, you don't have enough of a, you're not doing the setup right. Or this is where you need to tweak, and giving a little bit of feedback. Because as much as I would love everybody to come to every single, you know, training opportunity that we might have, there aren't that many training opportunities.
And this is going to come off the way it comes off, but again, kiting is a strongly recreational sport too, and so it's not like golf where there is a very clear, established, universal understanding of the premise of how something works. And then upon that is laid styles and various different approaches. But everybody holds the golf club the same way. And then there's subtle differences, you know, it's that sort of thing. So it's tough when we don't have a lot of instructors. So I think for the time being, like one of the things that I've really enjoyed watching, particularly everything that I've seen and experienced and being now in this current era is, the Sport Kite Pilots Lounge,
yes.
Watching Bruce Schenk go on for hours and hours. And that guy has picked up some skills. He's gotten really good on a stool line, and he's got some flow, and he's got some program. And Bruce, you know, I love you, but like, you know, if you just met you at face value, you know, it just first you're like the pirate, what? And then
yeah,
shit, pirate's got skills. And all of that. I mean, he had almost no time with anybody, but he just kept posting videos unashamedly. Mm-hmm. And allowing people to participate in that conversation with him. And he was completely,
he took the feedback.
Professionalism. He took the feedback and he didn't swallow it. He tasted it. He digested it. You know, so you don't have to become the feedback. You just engage it. It's like reading a book. You just let it flow across your brain panel. And if it works for you, you know, and you always try to expand, but if it works for you, you digest it. And if it doesn't, then you find more stuff. It's a continual, consumption of the craft, but
yes.
It goes back to in that, you know, even though we don't have a lot of video training per se, I think now, especially with technology, the way it is social media, there are a lot of places where, there are friendly communities and particularly in the dual line world, that's pretty much the only place that you can get wholesale education, because the tutorials the current tutorials that are available really were made 20 years ago. There's some trick tutorials, but in terms of like fundamental flying, how to land.
Yeah, I still have this grand idea for a series of tutorials that I want to set up and do. And hopefully with this change in job, we're going to be able to make it happen. This has been a long time pipe dream. But like you said, the tutorials that we do have are about 20 years old. I think actually your tutorials are some of the newer ones. But like the Prism ones, the Dodd ones, all of that, they've got some time on them. And it's not that they're not bad. They just don't resonate. And I'm like, I watch it and I'm like,
well, I this is not a slight to them, but when I watch almost every tutorial, I don't feel like the tutorial is talking to the pilot.
Exactly.
I feel like the tutorial is talking about the topic in a closed room to themselves, but they're not putting themselves in the position of the pilot sympathetically.
Yeah,
and I think that's the key to good information.
Yeah, so my idea for the tutorials, and you know what, I'm not gonna have heartburn if someone takes this idea and totally runs with it. I've just been wanting to do this for so long and hadn't had the time. Is that essentially? So it's a multi-faceted tutorial. So we'll take a skill. And just for this, I'm gonna use a half axle because it's a lower level skill, right? So we're gonna go with that, and we're gonna show how it's done or how it should be done the most clean, and then show someone who's brand new doing it and some of the pitfalls that they may run into and how to correct it. Now show someone who's like maybe mid-level and how they could tweak their half axle just a little bit to make it crisper. Now you have someone who is top level doing it. How
a little
could,
cross-sectioning.
Yeah, so you get like different flavors, because I don't need the absolute crispy perfectness of a top level flyer. I'm still trying to figure out, like, did I set it up wrong? Like, do I have to lean it back? You know, so I'm not I feel like when I watch some of these tutorials of upper level stuff, I'm like, that's so way above. Like,
well, I like that too, because it overcomes it's a lot of especially in dual line, a lot of the good flyers and some of the quad line flyers too, the ones that get really good, they develop affectations or particular nuances to their movement that are usually not integral to the maneuver, but it's something expressive that's come out over the top. So like Mark Reed, obviously brilliant fundamental, basically set the benchmark for distributing that information along with Dodd, of course, but almost every flyer like that, there's a certain style that doesn't necessarily translate. It's not a bad style, but that's that thing. And so that cross-sectioning, I like that because it shows the space between.
Yeah.
I think that's a really sharp idea.
Yeah. And I, again, using the example of the half axle there, because I've been taught two different ways. And there is the way that I think is correct. And there is a way that used a crutch to get me there. And undo that crutch is problematic, right? But if that's the only way that I learned, there's nothing to go back and help me unlearn that crutch to understand the body mechanics and how to do that. And that crutch was essentially tipping the wing back before yanking it forward and sending it around.
Yes.
But it did help. I couldn't make the thing happen without doing that. But now trying to unlearn that setup, I'm like, wait, you know, and I go back and I watch a half axle tutorial and I'm like, I don't get it.
Right.
I'm like, well,
that's the other thing with dual lines is that some kites actually require that slight nose up, then lean the top wing back because they just need that setup. And then a lot of the higher end trick kites, they don't need it. Like you're discovering now, it's just that pop, pop and it goes.
But yeah,
that's quite a journey. And a cross section on one of my favorites was Randy Greenway's tutorials back in the day.
Because
a lot of
I've
been flying kites forever. But then in 2003, I'd already been flying for better than a decade. I started to learn slackline tricks. And I learned most of the stuff watching his videos. And what I liked was that he'd show the tricks quite often done with a couple of different kites. And he'd point out, on this kite, you may find that you need a little bit of more of a something or other, you know. So it is a little kite dependent and it's style dependent, but having a more of a cross section would definitely provide more more meat to chew on.
So that's the idea, is that hopefully we'll make those happen so that it has different skill level a flyer is coming at a trick and different kite types, right? You know, we can talk about that in the skill level side. So really giving this like comprehensive, hopefully you as a flyer can take something out of this and learn how to either tweak or do the thing. And I'm a huge proponent of everybody should always be working on basics. So I definitely want to see some of these advanced trick flyers that went straight away. You know, we've got some of them that are somewhat local that, I mean, they're already doing TAS machines and all this other stuff, but their landings are sloppy. And it's like, you need to spend a little bit more, like you can't do a clean cartwheel to recover. And that's we were talking about, you know, the basics you should learn, you know, that's like, spend some time doing that.
You can't eat pixie sticks all the time. You need your meat and vegetables too.
Yes.
Very much.
Can't have your pudding.
Indeed.
So, all right. Well, John, you got anything else you want to drop in this little chat? I know we'll chat again. You've got Chervia coming up, and we've got World Cup coming up.
You know, I just keep tuning into the good channels, and you know, those of you guys out there listening, let yourselves be seen. Share your journey. Let other people throw pie. <Yeah. laughs> Because, you know, a little pie is good for you. I try to eat as much of it as I can. It's good for me too. And other than that, it's a great pastime. And, you know, we're all on the journey together.
Yeah. And a little self-promotion time. I know you've got, you've been spitballing some ideas for training camps coming up. Mm-hmm. And so if anyone's interested in doing private training or training camp, just go to your website. Would it be Kite Life, or what's the best way to get a hold of you?
The fastest way is kitesaresexy.com. Kites okay. are sexy. Yeah, that kind of gets you into the pipeline. Of course, I've got Kite Life. I've got Team Kite Life, Kite Forge. Got a lot of different things going on. But at the end of the day, if you want to learn about kites, you want instruction, I'm always happy to share. And, you know, I have my own stuff, my own products going on, but I like to think I'm pretty non-biased. I do a lot of referral stuff too. So if I can help connect somebody with somebody else in their area or to a resource that suits them better than anything that I have available, that's always the most important thing, because healthy, happy kite flyers are just good for everybody. So.
Yeah, we need more of them.
So. Absolutely. Yep.
All right, Don. Well, thank you very much for being on this episode.
Thanks for having me. Have fun in Berwick. Go Team USA. Go all teams. But, woo-hoo. You know. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I can't wait. And, you know, since Kite Forge is a supporter of Team USA.
Yeah.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that second half of the interview. We will be chatting with John quite a bit more here in the near future. So a big shout out to him, and thank you for having him here on the podcast. He is doing a handful of training sessions. So if you want to up your skill level, consider heading on over to his website, checking it out, joining him for some one-on-one training or team training or collective training. We also do have the Sport Kite Camp coming up. The first one is going to be May 17th through the 20th in Long Beach, Washington. That's a very informal one. We'll just kind of be hanging out and having fun, and all skill levels are welcome to join us there. We'll then be doing the fireside camp style one at the Washington State International Kite Festival again. And the third week of August, you'll be able to find the Sport Kite tent pretty easily down on the field. Just look for us. You'll find us. And then after that, we're looking at doing one in September. I think it's September 19th timeframe. We're going to head on over to Hampton Beach, New Hampshire. You can find out information about the Sport Kite camps and more on our website, sportkite.org. Just click on that Sport Kite Camp tab. If you're interested in having a Sport Kite camp in your neck of the woods, drop us a line. Let us know. We are kind of shifting some things up this year and hoping to make a lot more of them happen around the U.S. and hoping to get some international ones going. So if you'd like to see that happen, let us know. You can always message us either on our Facebook page or at info@sportkite.org. All right, I'm going to go ahead and sign off. And just as a reminder, in the coming weeks, we're going to be publishing a ton of episodes and videos and everything from the upcoming World Kite Cup as we join Team USA and their bid for the championships at the World Kite Cup. So we're going to try and do daily reports and interviews, and we're going to talk to a lot of the other teams and flyers there. So do stay tuned. Watch us here on the podcast and also watch us on YouTube and Facebook. We'll be putting out tons of stuff, and you definitely don't want to miss it. All right, so with that, I'm going to go ahead and sign off, and I will see y'all on the next one.